what it probably boils down to a little bit is that it does have these lamellate parampodia, which are sort of kind of the classic orthotoline parampodia. So unlike the most phylines, which have these cetiform parampodia. So I think that's probably why Carvalho placed it in that area. But it does, the phallotheca is not attached to the phallobase, which is what it would have to be if it was an orthotoline. And the vesica is definitely sort of this rigid strap-like vesica that we see in the phylines. So that combined with the fact that it doesn't have, you know, the K structures and the posterior walls really quite simple, then I think really what we're talking about with Lanochoris is it's tried and true phylining. This isn't all the database records that I have of Lanochoris so far, because some of them aren't in fact databases. So maybe, yeah, this is all the database records I have. It's not all the specimens that I have. And so you can see that it's really got quite a broad distribution throughout the Southwest Pacific. But when Carvalho first described Lanochoris, it was based on one species. Remember, it's a monospecific genus that was only found in this area, in New Guinea and on the New Britain as well. Here you can see the holotype locality here, but what I really want to highlight to you is this fact. There were 485 males and females in the paratype series. It's quite a paratype series. And so my question is, what can go wrong with 485 paratypes? What could possibly go wrong with that? Well, there was more than a dozen specimens in the paratype series that aren't even remotely close to Lanochoris. So in there are just a few examples. I mean, this is Lanochoris, it's a little round jobber, and you know, there's different subfamilies represented in this type series. So that's one thing that can go wrong with 485 paratypes. And obviously, you know, with a really long type series like that, there's the potential that there might be more than one species within it. And so when you start going through the material, there's definitely two different vesicas that we can find in there. Two very different left paramers that are in there. And here you can see that this left paramere right here pretty closely matches up with this LO3 right here. LO3, which is the one that seems to be what Carvalho was talking about when he described Lanochoris viridescens. On the dorsolateral surface of the pygophore has this tubercle that you can see zoomed in right there. That's not mentioned anywhere in Carvalho's description, he didn't necessarily, if he saw that, he didn't bring it up, but it really, it does stand out, so it seems like he would have brought it up. So what can go wrong? So clearly we've got two different species within this type series. There's no doubt about that. So what's the holotype? Because we want to find out what bears the name which of those two species bears the name Lanochoris viridescens. And Shepard Myers over at Bishop Museum, which is where the holotype is housed, just recently sent me this photograph. He took this photograph for me the other day so that I could, you know, make this determination. And let's see. The holotype's a male, according to Carvalho. But what is that? Does that look like a male to myriad people out there? So the holotype is a female, even though the publication says that the holotype's a male. So there's all these, there's growing problems with Lanochoris. And the general advice, at least in the mirrored world, is that if you've got the choice and you're going to describe a species and you're going to designate a holotype, then you want to make it a male, right? Because the males have really the most diagnostic features and are really easy to designate. And for phylines, the females tend to not be really character rich, and this might have been kind of the death knell for determining what is Lanochoris viridescens, because the females tend not to be very character rich. So female phylines with external characters, no way. But in fact, for Linocryus, they do have some really good characters. So we actually can, you know, figure out what this type is. And so here you see the subgenital plate in the female at the base of the ovipositor. Here's a species that's kind of trilobed and has these really characteristic seedy that are coming out from the top of it. This one, the subgenital plate's really quite small, and in this particular specimen is a little bit duffed in right there, but it's just a small little lobe. And then in this species over here, you can see you've got this big triangular subgenital plate. There's also some differences in the margins here in these sternites and the way that they are, how much these overlap the ovipositor itself. So there's some good characters. Also right here, you notice that there's visible sterna right here, as opposed to some of these others, where you really can't see much in terms of visible sternites between the base of the ovipositor and the meta legs. Here's some more examples here, and these kind of show you where the cocci are. So there's no visible sternites in that area. This is a manuscript name, obviously, because there's only one described species, but it's got this really thin, red-like subgenital plate here. But Linocryus viridescens, based on the type that that I saw from Shepherd, has this really, really kind of, I guess, what is that? What shape would you call that? Spatulate. There we go. Spatulate subgenital plate. And so, based on that, Linocryus viridescens actually matches up with LO1. Okay, which was not the illustrations that I showed you at the beginning of the talk. So the illustration of the type, or the illustration of Linocryus viridescens that's in Carvalho's original publication, is actually of a different species. And so how, you know, I'll end up dealing with that is yet to be determined. So in the end, we end up having 9 different species of Linocryus, and with some range overlap. This is a particularly weird distribution. I just thought, no way, that can't possibly be for real. But I've done dissections and of males from both areas, and they really jive up perfectly with one another. One interesting thing is that in these areas where you do have overlap, in particularly in the Philippines, there's overlap where two species were collected in the same collecting event, and the females, the one will have like a really big subgenital plate, and the other one will have just tiny, tiny little subgenital plate. So that, you know, I'm not sure that it's actually, you know, that they're pushing each other apart there or what's going on, but there's a lot more species than we originally thought in any case. What about host data? Because that's what we're, at least that's one of the things that kind of drew me into the plant bug world, is I'm sort of interested in plant, you know, host, or plant bug and host coevolution. And with Linocryus, all this material has come from light traps. Every bit of it, it's just, you know, covered with moth scales and looks horrible and all that sort of stuff. Every bit of it's come from light traps that I can tell. There's no host data associated with any specimen that I've run across ever. But they are covered with pollen. I mean, seriously covered with pollen. The male genitalia, particularly so. I found pollen inside of the female because the males are covered with pollen. And so they're literally just covered with pollen. So I took the SEMs of these pollen. I sent them to this guy at Australian National University who deals with pollen of the Southeast Asia area. And he says, and I didn't plant anything in his mind because I had an idea. I knew what I wanted it to be. And I didn't plant anything into his mind. And he confirmed what I really hoped it was going to be. And that's, he said, it's palm. It's very likely to be palm pollen. And the reason why that's interesting, I'll get to in just a second. So we don't conclusively have that host data, but you know, the pollen seems to be a good indicator. One of the last things is where in the Phyloni might we want to place Linocerus, because it does have these weird parampodia. This is from one of Toby Shue's paper on pretarsal and the phylogeny of the Myridae. And so we've got parampodia that are lamellate and convergent apically, and that's something that we find in the orthotalines, but we also find again out here in the phyloferines. The vesica of the male is rigid. I showed you that. The phallopheca is not attached to the phallobase, so that's why I said we're looking at the phylines. The left paramere of the male is boat-shaped. It's really not in Linocerus. It's very different from the sort of typical phyline paramere, in my opinion. But I put a little yellow on that I'm willing to be cautious on that, because some of them sort of do lean in that direction within there. The head concave behind, yeah, but not to the degree that it is in, like, Pyloferus and some of these other Pyloferines, but it's certainly not like an orthotaline head, at least some orthotalines. The posterior wall evaginated is the character for the Pyloferines, and so I put a red there because it's a stop. No, it does not. Linocerus does not have the posterior wall evaginated. Aggregations of scale like CD, it does not have, so again, that's a stop. Nope, don't go there. And then twisted vesica with well-developed secondary gonopore. Well, it does have a twisted vesica, but it doesn't have a very well-developed secondary gonopore at all. So I think, and this is, you know, totally no analysis done, but possibly will be in the future, that Linocerus probably fits down somewhere here around, along with the Pyloferines. And why does it matter that palm was the pollen of choice? Well, if you look at the Toby's paper on the Pyloferini, he talks about the evolution of hosts. They